Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
You're listening to a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. If you want to listen to us in real time, you can stream our show live weekdays at 9 and 11 a.m. Central. Thanks for listening and enjoy the show.
Good morning. I'm Carrie Miller. This is NPR News, and this is the Friday Roundtable. I was and still am a proudly picky eater, which means I'm a drag to have dinner with. No sense of discovery at the table. But for many parents, leaving their children to a fate like mine just isn't acceptable. So today, it's three roundtablers, including 13-year-old Milo Fleming, on how to raise an adventurous eater. And I want to hear from you, too. If you have an adventurous palate yourself, how are you encouraging that in your kids? And if you're the parent of a kid who just wants to eat macaroni and cheese and peanut butter, tell me how this goes in your household. You can tweet it to me, at Carrie, K-E-R-R-I-M-P-R. Milo Fleming is 13. He was a top three finalist for Top Chef Junior. Congratulations. I want to find out what you made, but we'll get to that in a minute.
For
Welcome.
Sure.
Good to have you here.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Ed Jenkins is with us. He's the creator of Lalo's Lunchbox, a video series for kids. Ed, welcome.
Hi,
good to have you here. Trisha Armstrong is a speech-language pathologist at Children's, where she specializes in working with kids with eating difficulties. And Trisha, welcome. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me.
Milo, what's the most adventurous thing you've ever made and eaten?
The most adventurous thing I've ever made, I couldn't really put a finger on it because I can't even keep track of how many things I cook. But the most adventurous thing I've eaten, I was at a sushi restaurant and I ate shrimp that was killed like seconds before I ate it and it was still moving in my mouth.
You should have seen the faces of Trisha and Ed when you said that. It was killed right before, so you picked it out.
Yeah,
what, in the restaurant?
So the sushi chef was like standing right in front of us and he had like these two like Santa Barbara spot prawns and we saw him like chop off their heads and like cut them down and I was like, hi! And he just like handed them to us and they were still like slightly moving and we're like, oh, do we just eat it? And he's like, yes, eat it.
And with no hesitation, you put that in your mouth and you ate it.
It was delicious, yeah.
Wow. So is that a sense of adventure on your part? Or is that, I really want to try the taste of this. Or is it really just more about being adventurous?
I mean, as a chef, it's definitely important to be adventurous because you have to be able to be willing to try any ingredient because you might work with it at some point. But I think it's also just kind of a cool experience to get to try something new every day.
Ed, I'm watching you watch Milo explain this. What are you taking away from the way he's describing
what
this is? Well,
I think that's awesome, you know, risk-taking and, you know, and also just discovery with food, you know. And I think Milo, you have something very just, you know, innate about you to do that. And I think for me, you know, when I was his age or even younger, I was completely the opposite.
Were you really?
Oh, yeah. I was the picky eater. If you see the dictionary, that would have been my face there. I mean, I was so bad. I didn't like macaroni and cheese. I was too picky with that. I didn't like ketchup, you know, and to this day, you know, I think the worst thing for me for eating was chocolate. I was so picky, I didn't even like chocolate.
My
and I still
gosh,
don't like
man.
Chocolate.
What planet are you from? What kid doesn't like chocolate?
I know.
Milo, what do you think when you hear that? Does it seem weird?
It definitely seems weird. I also just feel like if you start off a picky eater and no one is there to change it, you're going to maintain a picky eater to some extent, even as an adult. So I feel like it's important to kind of start early.
Trisha, I mean, that's basically what happened to me. My parents never forced me to be exploratory at the table, and here I am today. With that. Is Milo right? This is usually how this goes?
I think so. I think it's a lot easier as a busy parent to pick your battles. And sometimes trying a piece of fish for the first time is not the battle you want to choose after a 9, 10, 11 hour workday and baths to take and homework to get done. So it becomes a vicious cycle that plays over and over of eating the same foods and preparing the same things and not stepping out of that comfort zone.
Sounds like that's what was going on with you, Ed.
Yeah.
Same food over and over again?
Well, I mean, that's what I wanted. You know, that's what I asked for. And I mean, and my parents, they were great. I mean, they both, you know, they wanted me to try my fruits and veggies, you know, and they, you know, they tried to, you know, give that to me. But I think overall, I had that situation like a lot of kids do where, you know, it's the do's and don'ts. You know, you do it Or, you know, if you don't, then you can't have this, yeah. You know, or if you got to eat at least, you know, the two bite club, you know, you eat at least two bites of this. And and that pressure, I think, over time continued my finickiness.
Did your parents ever have to say that to you, Milo? If you eat this, you get to eat that?
I feel like, I mean, definitely, like, for every kid that applies, but, like, up until, like, probably age 4 or 5, I would, like, try anything at least once.
Oh, my gosh, that's so unusual. What? You must have some unusual gene or
yeah,
something.
I don't know why. You're just wired different. Yeah.
Yeah. And then, okay, so then after 4 and 5, you were more conscious of what you were eating.
Oh, yeah, for sure. So after 4 and 5, I, like, not only became more conscious of what I was eating, but that's when I started to get more interested, too, and, like, became, like, a chef and started cooking, you know?
Yeah. How unusual is it, Trisha?
Oh, it's just so unusual. Okay. It's so unusual. And there are so many steps that lead up to trying a food that for some kids, it's not about putting it in your mouth and tasting it and realizing that you like it. It's even looking at it. It's looking at a shrimp that's alive and thinking, you're going to put that where?
Oh, my gosh. Yeah. Tell me a little bit about more of the steps, just real quick, Trisha. So what does this all entail?
I think that's a piece that gets missing a lot is everything that goes into eating and preparing food. It's a very sensory experience, and you have to use all of your senses to really become a strong eater. So it starts with looking at it at a grocery store and looking at it when it's cut up to see that the outside looks like the inside and hearing what bacon sounds like when it's sizzling or smelling what it smells like when it's frying on the fry pan, smelling cookies. If you think about what we associate with happy eating, it's the smells and the sounds.
Right.
And that's just the most basic. And then you move into the touching it, holding it, putting it on your plate. And really the last thing to get to is putting it in your mouth. And yet for so many families, it's just try it, try it, try it. And it is, it's that constant pressure of you need to do this. And then using food as a reward. So it becomes a really hard cycle to break.
Yeah, I completely agree. In fact, you know, there is a difference between trying and swallowing, you know, because a swallow is a full commitment, you know, but trying is like, just like you're sharing was, it's just seeing the food, you know, touching it in the grocery store.
But I mean, Ed, for me, it's the trying. It's the experience of the texture and the taste. The swallowing is, if I've gotten past the trying, the swallowing probably isn't going to be that hard. It's just being willing to experience the texture of something like some shrimp that was wiggling 2 seconds ago.
But I think really the key, too, is that, you know, allowing kids to discover and allowing it as many times as you can, you use other senses. I mean, you're using obviously the visual, but I love what you're saying about the smells, the sounds, the, you know, the touch. Like when you go to a grocery store, have the children to pick which tomato you're going to pick. You know, some of them are ripe. Some of them are too ripe. Have them to try and to hold it and to touch and to maybe smell the strawberries. You know, if you're picking a thing of strawberries, you know, doing that is a try. You know, and I think the key also is no pressure. I mean, that is the, I think, one of the number one things, because without the pressure and having it to be a neutral experience with food, then you're allowing that discovery. I think what you know, Milo, what you had as a child was just discovery over discovery.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, and I think that's awesome.
Is there, for you, is there a difference between the try and the swallowing?
I think for sure. I think definitely like introducing kids to new foods and like kind of getting this in their head and like giving them a good experience with it, not necessarily even eating it, just getting them to kind of know it and understand it is really important. Like especially I feel like kids, like if they like try a food once and it's like prepared wrong, they'll be like, oh, this is disgusting. I'm never going to eat this again.
Give me an example. Can you think of one?
So like, I don't know, like say I ate pig intestine and it was completely overcooked and it was terrible and also it's all pig intestine, so yeah. Like that sounds nasty, but if I go to a 3-star restaurant and it's prepared perfectly, it could be absolutely delicious. So I feel like kids kind of get these like things in their minds that they can't really try it again if they had a bad experience. And I think you really need to have an open mind 24/7.
Trisha, yes?
Oh yes. I think what's hard for many families and probably many listening is that pig intestine feels so far away. You know, raw shrimp feels so far away. They just want their kid to eat the macaroni with the cheese sauce on it.
And that's a win.
That's a win for wow. many families, yeah. Or to not have to cook 2 or 3 separate meals. So it is something that gets in the head and you need to work on it. And, you know, a common mantra that we use is your body needs to try things at least 15 times before it knows if it likes it.
Really?
And that's not necessarily 15 swallows.
Is that science or what is that?
There's been some articles. No, there's been some articles, you know, in the world of food research and kind of my world of disordered eating research, that you really have to expose yourself to it a lot of times. And exposing, like Ed was saying, not swallowing it, but exposing it of having it on your plate next to you, or, you know, not just the cooking. The cooking is a great piece, but one thing we encourage families to do is have the kids clear their own plate, or clear the no thank you plate, we'll call it. So you don't have to eat the steak that mom and dad are eating, but you need to have a serving in front of you, and then you need to help clear that plate, because then that is a try. You're seeing it, you're smelling it, and you're touching it. Mm-hmm. You know, the skin on your body is the same as the skin in your mouth. So if you can't tolerate it on your fingers, what's going to make you want to put it in your mouth?
Yeah, you know, I definitely think there's something about our expectation when it comes to kids and foods. And I think we need to maybe change our perspective on that, because I think, for example, my situation with when I was a kid with macaroni and cheese. I hated macaroni and cheese when I was a kid.
What is there not to like about macaroni and cheese?
But you know, there was a change. And I remember the change because after school, I was, you know, when I was a kid, both my parents worked. And so I was at someone's home and she would make, you know, mac and cheese for me as an after school snack. And I remember telling her, you know, I didn't like it. I didn't want it. But she continued to bring that to the table. She continued to do that. And I think over time, I touched it. Mm-hmm. That was it. It was just there. You know, I maybe put it in my mouth and spit it out. It was okay to spit it out. You know, and eventually over time, it became something I really enjoyed. You know, now I love mac and cheese. But it was that allowing me to explore it without pressure. You know, being able, like I said, to politely spit it out, not just spit on your plate, but get a napkin and you can spit it out politely, teaching kids table manners in that process. I mean, that is one way to get them to move forward with that.
So for as many times as I've seen snails on a dinner table, I have never, ever been able to get past the idea that it's, as with oysters, it's going to feel slimy and icky. And Tricia, I also feel like, what am I really missing? Who cares? Well, I don't have to have the slimy thing.
That's exactly it. And I think that's where you need to decide as an adult, what is your priority?
Okay.
You eat a diet, I'm sure, varied in fresh fruits and fresh vegetables and meats and proteins and good, healthy foods for your body. So is it something that is negatively impacting your life to not eat snails or oysters? I would argue no.
Okay.
But, you know, that's kind of a decision you would have to make. But when we talk about oysters and snails, have you picked up the snail? Have you pulled the meat from inside the shell?
No.
Have you put it on the cracker? So that's where you would need to start.
Also, I feel like if you hate the idea of oysters, then try having fried oysters instead of oysters on the half shell. Because I used to hate oysters. I'm not even afraid to say
that. We found something that you don't like.
Because I like to say I have an advanced palate. But after trying oysters several times and trying fried oysters and baked oysters, I could sit here and eat 10 oysters on the half shell. And I think they're delicious.
Raw.
Yeah, exactly.
Because you progressed.
Because I worked my way up. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
You have to start somewhere.
What do you think, Milo? What am I missing by not eating snails and oysters on the half shell?
By not even thinking about it. If you see it on the menu, you're like, oh no, you got to try it. Even if you hate it, it's going to cost you $17. Order it and try one.
Wow, what a great spirit. You're listening to the Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about picky eaters. I know parents around are going, oh, I've got to listen to this. We've got 13-year-old Milo Fleming here. He's a top three finalist for Tricia Armstrong is with us. She's a speech pathologist at Children's, and she also specializes in working with kids on eating difficulties. And Ed Jenkins is the creator of Lalo's Lunchbox, a video series for kids. I watched some of your videos. They're just great.
Oh, thank you.
I mean, you're trying to get kids even. One of the ones I watched had bananas flying out of the lunchbox. I mean, you are not starting, I guess I would say, with, you know, a high sophisticated, you must try oysters on the half shell. You're really just trying to get kids to eat some of the basics.
Yeah, I'm just trying to introduce fruits and veggies to kids in a way that's fun, that's non-intimidating for
Why
them.
Are fruits and veggies intimidating, do you think, to kids?
Well, I think it has a lot to do with the pressure. You know, there is this expectation that you're going to eat this. You need to eat this. This is good for you. And I think that food should be enjoyed. It should be fun.
Even if you do need some of this stuff?
Absolutely. It should be enjoyed, because having joy in your eating experience is one of the pleasures of life.
So this is why you were putting a lot of humor and joy right into the videos.
Yeah, and I wanted to make sure, too, that I wasn't, let's say if I had a vegetable come out, it wasn't, oh, well, this vegetable is good for your eyes.
You or don't this talk is down to the kids,
no,
I noticed
No, I just
that.
Want to say, hey, this is what we have. What do we do with it? You know, oh, these bananas are coming out. This broccoli is coming out. What are we, you know, what are we going to experiment with? How are we going to make this to be something fun? And I think in that process, I'm trying to teach kids that it's okay to see a food, to try a food, and it's also okay to say no, thank you. I mean, that's one thing we have to consider, is that some of the language we have around food, the yucky, the gross, I hate it, and this and that, and really encouraging kids to use different words like mm-hmm. I enjoy or I don't enjoy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
Tricia, what do you say to parents about that, the language that you're using around not wanting or wanting food?
Yeah, well, I'm a word person, so yeah. I love that idea, and it's the words we use, and it's the facial expressions we make, and as picky eaters ourselves start having kids ourselves, it's this perpetual cycle, and it's the look on our face when, you know, our husband wants to eat something that maybe we don't want to eat or some of those nonverbals. So it is important to use words like different or new or exciting, and not like words like slimy or alive. I mean, maybe. Words that aren't as intimidating, for sure. And I think a big part of it is talking about what you're doing. We are in a society where we're always doing 18 different things at once. And as I've worked in our feeding clinic at Children's for years and years, that's one of the biggest things we've noticed is distracted eating. There's distracted driving and there's also distracted eating. And you can't learn about new foods if you're not focusing on those
foods.
That's
such a great point. How often do families actually take a moment to sit around the table to say, we're doing this and this is why we're doing this, again, without this language of it's good for you and that's it, right?
Mm-hmm. You know, I think, well, there's a person, Ellen Satter, who is this researcher. She's a phenomenal, and she has amazing research about this very subject. And she really developed something called the division of responsibility, that parents have a responsibility at the dinner table, and kids have a responsibility, and it's divided. And that parents, you choose what the kid is going to eat, when they're going to eat it, and where they're going to eat it. But kids, they get to choose if and how much. And keeping it, as Ellen would say, keeping those responsibilities, parents and kids, you create more harmony in the meal times.
Wow. Yeah. Milo, it sounds like you get to share a lot of the responsibility for how the whole family eats.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Also, I feel like, for sure, but I think it's really important on the parents' behalf to start raising non-picky eaters, because if you have like a very like specific diet where you don't like trying other things, you can become like an unhealthy eater as you grow up. And I think if parents don't kind of enlist their responsibility as their kids are growing up, they kind of need to make a change, because that's going to hurt them later in life.
So you're hearing this roundtable on how to raise an adventurous eater. And I'd love to hear from you on Twitter. If you have an adventurous palate yourself, what are some of the techniques that you're using to encourage that in your kids? And if you're the parent of a kid like Ed was, who wouldn't eat anything, including chocolate and mac and cheese. I thought I was like the pickiest eater ever. No, Ed. No, you put me to shame. You've got a kid who just wants to eat mac and cheese and peanut butter. How does this go in your household? Tell me a little bit about some of the things you've tried, you know, to get that kid to be more adventurous. You can tweet me on that at Carrie, KerriMPR. One of the things that we were talking about off air was the grocery shopping. And Milo, you do a lot of the cooking for the family at 13, but you also go along, obviously, on the shopping trips.
Yeah.
And why? So what happens when you walk into a grocery store?
So the thing about grocery stores for me is if you're just going to like a Target or a Walmart or a Cub, you're going to see the normal things you have. They're going to have onions and potatoes and like canned vegetables and stuff. But if you don't branch out and go to, say, a Hmong market downtown or go to the farmer's market, you're not going to become like a better cook and a better person. Because the thing is, if I go to Target, they're going to have basil. It's going to be $4 for a pack of like four leaves, and it's going to taste like nothing. Uh-huh. Then I can go to the Hmong market and get a pack of Thai basil. It's like $1.50, and it's like this explosion of flavor in your mouth. So you never know what you're going to find until you find it. So you really always have to kind of be experimenting and adventuring in the food world, and especially when it comes to groceries and where you go and where you find them.
What we were talking about was how intentional this has to be with the shopping. Yeah. And I was saying, oh, you got to spend so much time thinking about what you're going to eat, and then you eat it and it's over like in 10 minutes. But Trisha, I think you were saying, yeah, intentionality with the shopping is pretty important.
It is. And again, you think about how many people want to bring their children to the grocery store.
Yeah.
You know, as a mother myself, it's a lot faster and a heck of a lot easier to just go and get it yourself or do Amazon Now or Coburn's Delivers or whatever the case may be. So I think if that feels too big, what Milo's saying is fantastic. But if that feels too big, just even interacting with it in your own kitchen, including the kids to cut the apple open and see what the apple looks like on the inside. I've worked with kids in the past who have no idea that an orange is the same as a pack of mandarin oranges. So they'll eat mandarin oranges, but they would never branch out to an orange because they've never peeled an orange. Because in their lunch goes a thing of mandarin oranges, goes a container of mandarin oranges. So it's just even interacting with what's in your own cupboard. And it feels really big as a parent. How am I going to do this? I work full time. I've got three kids. They're in activities. So even just starting with one meal a day, one meal or snack a day to say, okay, everybody in the kitchen, you know, you cut the carrots, you serve the potatoes. We're going to sit down together, no screens, and we're going to talk to each other for 15 minutes, clear the table and be done. Even just once a day to start with makes a huge difference.
You know, this is when you first said that to see what food looks like on the inside. I was like, what? Most people know what the inside of an apple looks like. No?
A lot of kids don't. And if you think about it as a parent, when you're in a rush, you are cutting the apple, serving the apple, eat the apple. Or you know they won't eat the peel. I was guilty of this, and I do this for a living with my own kids. You know, they never saw me open the jar of peanut butter to make the peanut butter sandwich. You just peel the bread open and there it is. Yeah. So then when they saw the jar of peanut butter, there was this shock of what's that? That goes on bread. So then putting it on a banana was completely out of the ordinary. So it is even just including them in that process. But sometimes you got places to be.
And, also, go ahead.
The process is really important because if you think about it, you eat three meals a day every day for your whole life. And if you're not enjoying it, it's a waste of your time. And you need to find a way to enjoy it somehow. And that's something that's really important in life.
Milo, a minute ago, you used the phrase a better person for eating well. Do you believe that?
Oh yeah, for sure.
Why?
It makes you more interesting. It makes you more interested in life and in food, and it just kind of enlightens you to like the world of food you've been missing out on, because I mean, food is delicious.
Yeah, I think it does make you a more interesting person. Ed?
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with it. I think that more kids are involved in the process, the more skin they have in the game, the more they're going to be willing to be adventurous in the opportunity. You know, I think I love what you're saying. I mean, even if, for example, you wanted to say, let's grow something, like we have a garden, have them to plant the seed in the ground, have them to see something grow. And then, oh, it's a tomato. Okay, is it ripe yet? No, not yet. And then now it's time. Now they take it off the plant. They're washing it. They're going to be more likely to try what they grew.
For sure.
You know? Absolutely.
So from everything from going to the farmer's market, I love that idea, what you're saying. And then, or even at home, or even growing something, you know, all those are great opportunities for kids to discover. But the key to it is no pressure.
For sure.
Because let's say, for example, they help you with the making a salad, but they don't want to eat it. That's okay, because it's still a try. You know?
Is that okay, Trisha?
I think if you have an end game, absolutely. Yeah. You know, at some point you're going to have to say, okay, great. You know, you washed the lettuce, you cut the lettuce, you've served the lettuce, you've touched the lettuce, but now we need to work on getting it to the mouth. So chewing is actually a big step. So for some kids, when we get to that point, when they just draw the line at, I will not put this in my mouth, we kiss it. We kiss it, and then we put it, what we call, in the all-done bowl.
Really?
Your face is hilarious right now, Carrie. I wish I had a camera. It sounds so bizarre.
It does.
But when you break down the steps of eating, once we get it towards the mouth, it's kiss it, lick it, hold it between your teeth.
Oh my gosh, wow.
And then bite it, then chew it.
Oh my gosh, you must be the most patient person on earth.
Maybe it worked. Don't talk to my children. I mean,
and this works.
This gradual
integration into the mouth, chewing and swallowing.
It absolutely works.
Do kids develop this repulsion for some food? I mean, is it something that's developed, or where does this come from?
Oh, there's the million-dollar question. You know, where does it come from? It's so hard to say, and it's so variable. For some kids, it's medical problems. It's reflux they've had since birth, and all they know is pain. For other kids, they've aspirated. For other kids, it's food availability, and it's a lack of food. Or, you know, a big issue we see with some of the lower-income families is access to real food, access to fresh fruits, fresh vegetables, things that don't come in a container.
Like, I know if it comes out of a box, I'm good with that, but what's this pomegranate sitting here? Milo, do you eat anything that comes in a container?
I mean, well, of course I do. I like to have a unique palate, but I also am a kid, and, like, you know, we can only go to the grocery store and the farmer's market so many times. So.
Okay, what's the trashiest thing you eat, Milo? Chips,
ramen.
What, ramen?
Yeah,
that doesn't count.
Hold up, though. I don't use a flavor packet. You use the noodles, and then you make a broth from scratch.
Oh my gosh, from scratch! Oh my gosh, how'd you get in here, Myla? You're listening to a Friday Roundtable. It's a conversation about how to create adventurous eaters. Milo Fleming, he's like some superhuman 13-year-old. I don't know where we found him. He was a contestant and a top three finalist for Top Chef Junior. What was the experience like?
I mean, the experience was amazing. I wouldn't trade it for the world. I got to meet so many amazing chefs, people. I got to travel. And also just to be able to be in a commercial kitchen, be able to cook whatever I want and not have any limits is just amazing.
I mean, this is high pressure, Milo.
Oh, yeah.
You always have a deadline, right? And you're having to come up with some pretty sophisticated food on the spot. Give me an example of what you made.
One dish that I won the challenge, it was sweet and sticky roast quail with miso sea beans and lemongrass oil-infused caviar.
What? Is this something you'd made before?
Never in my entire life.
How'd you think about that? How'd you think that up?
Honestly, I don't even know how I think that up. I could sit down here, and if you give me an hour, I could come up with like 25 recipes without even making them. I don't know how it works, but I just know the proportions in my head and like the flavors, and it just happens. I don't even.
Okay, sweet and sticky quail.
Okay, sweet and sticky quail.
With quail, right?
Yeah, sweet and sticky quail.
With
miso roast sea beans.
Sea beans around it. Okay, and then what?
Ocetra caviar with lemongrass oil.
How did that come out?
So the challenge, we had to do a surf and turf challenge. We had to do a new take on surf and turf, so not like a filet mignon and a lobster tail, but like quail and caviar, quail and crab. And I really just wanted to kind of elevate it, and instead of do like a piece of steak and then a piece of fish, which is kind of nasty, I kind of tried to elevate it and like go a completely like different route.
Yeah. So did the judges like it?
Oh yeah, the judges loved it. I won the challenge. Actually, Graham
you
Elliott
won the challenge.
Graham Elliott was licking his fingers because the quail juice was like all over his fingers.
Ed, is that ever going to make it into the lunchbox?
Wow, maybe one day. Maybe I'll have to, you know, I'll have to get that recipe from you.
What's the thing you learn most about yourself in the experience? Besides just being a good cook.
Well, yeah, but I just grew so much as a chef and a person throughout it because, I mean, it's a hard experience. It's like 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, intense pressure every hour.
You're going to take criticism, right?
Yeah,
not
exactly.
Everybody is going to be nice to you.
You have to be vulnerable, and you have to be also strong. And it's really hard, but when you're done with it all, it's like such a great learning experience, and I've just grown so much as a person.
Have you ever made the quail recipe since then?
No, never. You can't find good quail anywhere.
Is that right?
Yeah, somehow they got their hands on it.
I know that.
Yeah.
Can you guys imagine any of the kids that you work with being willing to try something like the quail that he made?
You know, I think it's just one of those things where if you have those basic principles in place where they're just exploring and there's no pressure and there's a good sense of play and enjoyment, kids would be willing to eat that. I mean, that is amazing that you made that. But I think also it is something that it tastes amazing too. And that, you know, if it tastes good and you know, I think there's hope for anyone to be able to get to that place.
Okay, so I was talking to one of our producers, Sam Chu, who's a really good cook and an adventurous eater, about this. And he was saying that his girls have loved oxtail soup since they were 3 years old, because the marrow in the oxtail bone makes the soup really rich and savory. This is exactly what you guys are describing here, right? Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a sense of play. They love it because he makes it. He's their daddy. But it also, but getting past that, it also tastes good.
Yeah, you know, I think, like, for me, one thing I did like when I was a kid was grits. Because my dad is from Alabama.
Ah.
My mom's from Mississippi. And, you know, that was something culturally that we always would have. You know, in the morning, we would have grits. And I wouldn't, you know, and I would be surprised when people say they put sugar in their grits. And I always have put salt. You know, in the grits.
That's the Southern way, isn't it? Yeah.
You know, and so I, you know, it's something where I remember, even time now when I make grits, I think about my dad. I think about, you know, those experiences I had as a kid. You know, so sometimes, you know, it may not be something that other people would eat, but I really enjoy, you know, enjoy that. It reminds me of what I came from.
I love that, Tricia. This is something I wanted to get to, is kind of family history, family culture around a food, right?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a
Absolutely.
Way to overcome an initial oxtail bone soup? What?
I think so, because I suspect for us, we kind of take a step back like, oh my gosh, that's adventurous. But they might not know it yet because they are exposed to it time and time and time again. And it's those frequent repeated exposures to the sights, the smells, the words that surround it that desensitize that and make it not as big and not as scary.
Yeah.
I mean, my kids called everything chicken. You know, what kind of chicken are we having tonight? Well, we're having pot roast chicken or pork chop chicken. We're having oxtail chicken. And they would eat anything as a meat as long as I called it chicken. So that's what we did. And then eventually word chicken dropped. So,
Milo, what's the food that when you think about making that, you really think about the love of your family and the joy of hanging out with your family? Is there a particular dish?
Oh, yeah. So my mom makes this baked chicken with bacon and sauerkraut.
Mm, and that sounds good.
She got it from a cookbook that her brother gave her, and actually made it on an episode of Top Chef Junior.
Ah.
But like every now and then she'll make it on a Friday night, because it takes like a good 2 hours to make, and like that we won't go to bed until like late that night because it takes so long. But it's so delicious, and like everyone like comes in the kitchen, like say I'll chop up an onion, then go play Scrabble with my dad, then my mom will like skin the chicken thighs, and like it'll be like this thing that we do as a family. But then we all come together to eat it, and it's like so good. So like even if like if we'll have a batch that wasn't as good as the one last time, we'll still like gobble it up because we made it as a family, and it's still like what it is.
Do you think we could put that recipe on our website?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Your mom's willing to share the secret recipe of that. You know, when he was describing that, you two wanted to talk about structure around family meals.
Mm-hmm.
There, I mean, look at the way he just kind of described how they go through the experience of making that dish.
Mm-hmm.
What's so important about structure?
Well, I think it is the foundation. Like anything, you're building a house, you have to have a good foundation. And the foundation to healthy eating for kids and even the household is family mealtime. There's been so much research about the importance, how much kids are learning, even through conversation and through the activity of having a family meal.
And family means so many different things to so many people. You know, family can be one mom and five kids. It can be two dads and no kids. Mm-hmm. It can be anything. But I think taking whatever your family structure is and whatever your family unit is and meeting it there. So if it's, you know, if it's just two people, that's still fine because you're interacting with somebody else and you're doing it together.
Yeah. And I think having structured time like that, and family could even be friends, you know, but having a structured time where we're eating breakfast this time, we're eating dinner at this time, is going to help. In fact, that's probably the first, like, step one when it comes to trying to create new habits in the home.
Where are you guys on the clean plate idea? You have to clean your plate. Tricia?
I do not agree with clean plate club.
Why?
I grew up in a clean plate club.
Did you? Well, okay, so what did that mean for you?
It meant you finished what was on your plate if you wanted to be done. More my grandparents than my parents.
No matter what was on the plate, you had to finish
it. No matter what was
it.
On the plate. Mm. My mom will kill me for saying this, but she and I had it out. I sat at the table for 2.5 hours one time
for
one scallop.
Tricia.
What?
One scallop?
One scallop. She won.
You ate it.
I ate it. I don't eat scallops today. because I really think it was, I think it was because of that. And
I got to make you some scallops.
I know. I have tried them since, and I don't dislike them as much, but you get a relationship you get a mindset around food, and half of the battle is getting over that mindset then. So I think it goes back to what Ed was saying with division of responsibility, and you have to eat an age-appropriate serving. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily need to clean your plate. I am a firm believer in letting kids regulate their appetite as much as they can, because we have to be careful not to encourage overeating.
Yeah.
And we need kids to recognize hunger. So it's all goes back to setting up good structure.
This is something my parents never forced us to clean our plates because they didn't want us to be overeaters. And to this day, I never clean. Isn't it funny how childhood habits come with you into? Do you clean your plate, Milo? Do you should?
Of course. But I also feel like having a clean plate club enlisted for kids, it puts an unnecessary amount of pressure on them to like, oh, I have to do this, otherwise I'm going to be in trouble. And then it can kind of give them a negative relationship with food. And I think it's really important for parents to realize what they're doing and kind of take a step back.
Yeah. And I also think, too, it's important for kids to understand, kind of like what Trisha was saying, what hunger is and what being satisfied is. And, you know, that's something personal, you know, that how do I know that I'm hungry? How do I know that I'm satisfied? What does it take for me to be satisfied? And everyone has to kind of learn how to walk in that. But yet, if I come in and impose what I think you should eat and how much you should eat, then they're not really learning in themselves what that feeling is.
So this is interesting because you know that other cultures have different versions of what being satisfied at the table is, right? Mm. You hear Europeans say it isn't eating until you're so full you can barely push it. You hear the Japanese say it's always having a space there to say I could have more, but I'm exercising restraint. How do you talk to your kids and how do you role model what being satisfied as an eater is?
I think it depends on their age, most certainly. For little ones, I will usually recommend you have one of each of the food that you want to eat and then whatever the power food is, I'll call it at that meal. So let's say you need them to eat chicken, okay? And you don't want to say clean your plate. I'll often start with you need to take as many bites as you are old because their age is a very concrete number. And then it switches the reward to being done. So instead of saying if you eat this, you can have the ice cream, it's you are 2 years old, you need to take two bites. And then if you choose to have more, you can, but you need to take two bites. Now, not necessarily for new, really hard foods, but for foods where you know if you let them, they'd eat six containers of yogurt and never eat the chicken.
Yeah.
Right? So then it's you need to eat this, and then you can have more of that, but not making one food better than the other, just talking about what they do for your body. So you need this because this makes your muscles strong, and you need this milk because it makes your bones strong, and you need the vegetables because it makes your eyes strong.
So that's for young kids.
For young kids,
yeah. But how about as you get older and you're really, and you do want kind of a family ethic around what it means to eat well, but not overeat.
I shift a lot into serving sizes.
Okay.
You know, there are recommended serving sizes for every food on every label. So, you know, for my kids, if they feel hungry and they want to sit down and eat three oranges, okay.
Yeah.
That never happens. What they want to do is sit down and eat three servings of cereal.
Yeah.
And eat a box of cereal in one sitting. So what we'll say is you can have one serving. What is a serving on the box? You can have one serving and then something else. And if you're still hungry after you have the something else, then come back to me. And we have sometimes foods and anytime foods. And an anytime food is anytime you're hungry. It's a piece of cheese. It's a slice of deli turkey. It's an apple. It's an apple with peanut butter. It's a handful of almonds. Those are more nutritionally packed than Doritos or salt and vinegar chips, which is my son's obsession.
Also, honestly, like for me, if I don't have like a piece of meat and then some rice and then some baked vegetables and a salad, it's not going to like make me feel like satisfied. Like I'll be like, okay, I had this, but where's the rest? And like that, like subconsciously, you're being healthy by eating everything on your plate. And it just doesn't feel like a rounded meal. Like looking at it as a chef, if I just see like a piece of chicken and some sauce, that's not a dinner. You have to have some vegetables and a salad.
Uh-huh.
Like you need to kind of round it off, and like then it feels more like it's not only more healthy for you, but then you get full easier. Like, I could sit here and drink, like, four Cokes and have it be, like, 600 calories, or eat, like a bowl of salad this big and have it be, like, 300 calories.
So satiation for you, Milo, is this idea that you've had a well-rounded meal.
Yeah.
So what's your favorite snack?
So at like Target, you can buy these little containers of almonds, and they'll be like spiced almonds or smoked almonds.
Okay,
and those
well, that's
are
not
like,
so bad. That's pretty good.
If you like six of those, it fills you up, and it's like, oh, they're so good, you know?
Yeah. Where do you guys come down on snacking? How much of it do you encourage or allow? Trisha?
I try to encourage mindful snacking. Yeah. So if you're going to snack, you should sit down.
That's the antithesis of what good snacking is all about.
Isn't that the truth?
Yeah.
Now, the real world comes in. So the best way to get kids to try new food is to make sure they're hungry.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
if you're snacking all day long, you're not hungry. And I would bet, Carrie, if you were eating, if you hadn't eaten in 24 hours and all that was there was some oysters or some snails, you'd probably have a couple.
Okay. So you got me there.
Yeah. So, I mean, we are very fortunate that that's not usually a factor. But the first thing we'll do in feeding clinic when we have families come in is look at, okay, fill out a 3-day food record and show us where you're eating. And if you're snacking all day long and you're not hungry, what's your motivation to try the new food?
Except that the culture encourages constant snacking, right?
And
there's
also
food everywhere.
Yeah, also like if you go to the store and like buy a bag of Doritos, there's monosodium glutamate in it, which makes you want to keep eating and you can't stop eating.
Right.
And that's kind of a problem because our culture is kind of encouraging overeating and unhealthy eating and
just constant eating all day.
It just ruins your diet and ruins your want to try anything else because you just want that MSG, you know?
Yeah, I wonder how many of us actually experience hunger. Mm-hmm.
And that's the importance of those structured meals times we're talking about, because if you have that, then you're building expectation that I will be eating. So when you have that child after school saying, I'm starving, I want to eat something, can I eat something? You say, well, you know, at 5:30, this is when we eat. You know, and just having that so they can anticipate something routine, something that they can expect. You know, but then if also too, like what you're saying about anytime foods, having something, okay, well, here's a cut of apple. If you want to have something to hold you over.
It's not going to satisfy most kids.
No, that's just it. That's just it. And so I think everything is a balance. And I think too, this is where you get into the differentiation between a typically developing child and one who has disordered eating or one who has big gaps in their overall nutrition status. You know, do we need him getting more calcium? Do we need her getting more fruits? And having your pediatrician or your primary care provider really help guide you in this is what they eat. Is this enough? Is this varied enough? Because very often what we look at is weight gain and growth. And just because you're on the growth chart doesn't necessarily mean you're healthy.
Yep.
And that is a big struggle with families because you strive to get your kid on the growth chart. But you've got to make sure it's
meaning
healthy.
Meaning that they are as tall and what?
So that their weight and their height are proportionate.
Okay.
So
parents will say, well, look at this. He's in the right where he ought to be.
Yes, exactly. And it's like, well, he's right where he ought to be because he's eating Doritos and drinking juice all day.
I see. Okay.
And that's not necessarily what he needs for good brain development. Or what we see more often is little ones, you know, who are riding that third percentile, barely holding onto the growth chart, who will eat a fairly varied diet, but they want them bigger. They want them weighing more. So then the family's like, eat more, snack more, eat more, snack more. When really sometimes what you need to do is just see where your child is growing. You know, it's a curve for a reason. Some are at the top, some are at the bottom. And as long as you're following your own curve and your pediatrician or primary care provider is comfortable with that, that needs to be kind of what guides it.
I have a question for you, Milo, from Suzanne, our producer that booked the round table. So she's got two kids, 5 and 2, and she said that eating food with spices, being able to introduce foods with spices into her kids' diet would make it more interesting for her and her husband to eat too. So what would you recommend to Suzanne about how to do that?
Soups. Like if you do like a spice crusted chicken breast, it's gonna be like, why is my chicken all like black and brown? But if you incorporate it into something and if you toast your spices and it just makes them like a whole new thing, it can really like up the ante for not only kids but for the parents that are eating it too.
So why did you say soups though? Right.
Because
away?
I mean soups you can really soups think of it almost as like a savory smoothie. You know, you can incorporate anything in it. Like I could have a soup and like it's like a light brown, but it has carrots and peanuts and cabbage and all these different fruits and vegetables, and the kids wouldn't even know. As long as it tastes good, they're not going to care, but they're going to end up getting all their nutrients and vitamins and fiber and protein through this one thing, and they're going to still think it's delicious because it is.
Ed, what kind of advice would you have for Suzanne on this?
Yeah, I would actually have them to explore even some of the seasons, you know, seasoning. You know, open up, taste it. Do you enjoy it? Do you not enjoy it?
Look at the bottle,
touching it. And also, you know, experiment with it. Let's put it in this. Let's put it in that. Does it make something change? Does it change? You know, because even they can learn through just the observation and discovery of that.
What was the epiphany for you from, because we started out with you talking about what a super picky eater you were. What changed? What was the moment?
You know, I think really the moment is when I went to college.
No.
Yeah, there's more hope out there than me, I tell you that.
Yeah.
But I think one of the reasons why it worked for me is because I was introduced to different types of foods, different friends.
At college?
In college. Okay. And there was no pressure. You know, you could choose to eat it or not. You could choose to do this or not. We all hung out. We all made something, and I could choose to have it or if I didn't. And I think over time, that, you know, freedom, you know, that kind of autonomy helped me to become more creative and discover.
So where'd you go to school?
I went to UW Milwaukee.
So okay, mm-hmm. So but your father was Southern.
Yeah, both parents were, yeah.
So you grew up in this household where mm-hmm. you were probably eating some foods that they really loved from where they grew up.
Mm-hmm.
And then you go to UW-Milwaukee and you're exposed to a lot of different kinds of food?
Well, you know, it's just like, you know, I learned about being vegan in college.
Okay.
I learned about what a vegetarian is. You know, we didn't have necessarily that. You know, when I grew up in Wisconsin, we didn't have that. But, you know, and just understanding, you know, things like quinoa and tofu.
Yeah.
I mean, those are new things. And at first, I tell you, I didn't enjoy those things. But over time, when you try new things, you have different experiences, it does grow with you.
So, Milo, what's the holy grail recipe for you? The one that you would love to perfect?
I mean, I've been doing a lot of homemade pastas lately because I think it's so fun. It's a good
use of your
weekend.
So you make the noodles yourself?
Yeah, from scratch.
Oh,
and on, like, I think last Saturday, I made handmade aglioli filled with roasted garlic and sweet potato puree. And then this weekend, I'm actually catering a three-course dinner, and I'm making that for the three-course dinner. Because, like, for me, if I'll make a recipe and it turns out good, then that'll be, like, one of my recipes that I have for sure, and, like, I'll write it down.
Wait a minute. You're catering this for not your family, somebody else?
No, it's a family friend, but I'm still being paid. I've started, like, on my Instagram, I've said, I'll cater your dinner party, DM me. So I'm just trying to kind of get the word out there and kind of become an entrepreneur.
Wow. Okay. So when you cater a food at someone's house,
and
I want you to do this at my house.
Okay.
All right.
Sure.
Okay. I have to probably come get you, right? I have to drive you there.
Well, I mean, I think my parents they're being really supportive and they're going to like drive me over and like get all my ingredients, but yeah.
Okay. So how would you plan a meal for somebody that wants you to cater?
Okay.
What kinds of things do you find out about?
So first of all, I have to ask if there are any dietary restrictions because like I'm not going to make peanut Thai soup if someone's like deathly allergic to peanuts.
Right.
And then I ask about any like things that you want to be included, like say there's a meat that they want to have for dinner, or say they've been really craving chocolate cake, then I'll make them a chocolate cake. And then I'll ask any budgetary restrictions. So if they're only willing to pay like $10, I'll make a menu that only costs $10.
What?
Or if they can pay $100+, then I'll just keep going and going. So then I kind of structure it around there, and then I'll ask how many courses they want, how many people they're having, and then I'll kind of build it off of that.
And you come into the kitchen and you pull this all off yourself.
Well, I mean, I'm prepping all day long, and then that night I'll have all my mise en place ready, and I'll just start cooking, and then they'll be ready.
You are fantastic.
That's really.
Hey, thank you all. This was a really fun roundtable.
Oh, yeah, for sure. Thanks
yeah,
for having
thank
me.
You, and
thank
good
you.
Luck with the business, Milo. Really good to have you here. That's the Friday Roundtable. Ed Jenkins, Tricia Armstrong, and Milo Fleming, 13 years old, who is a top 3 finalist for Top Chef Junior.
This was a recording of a live radio show on NPR News. To add your voice to our discussion, you can call in at 800-242-2828 or tweet Carrie at @KERRINPR. And if you miss us live, you'll find all of our shows by subscribing to this podcast. If you have questions, you can email us at talk@npr.org.